Massachusetts is steeped in history. We're swimming in notable trails, houses, churches, documents, traditions, even ships. But history is a living thing, reevaluated not just when something comes to light or when culture shifts over time, but also when there are new voices inviting us to revisit old history through a different lens. I'm Jennifer Smith, and this is The Codcast, Commonwealth Beacon's podcast about policy and civic life here in Massachusetts. And to kick off Women's History Month, last week I sat down with Commander Billy J. Farrell, the first female leader of the USS Constitution, which is famously nicknamed Old Ironsides and the oldest commissioned warship in the U.S. Navy. Commander, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
For listeners, we are not currently on a boat. We are at the Old North Church and Historic Site for a few reasons. One of them is easy to cover. You're going to receive Old North Illuminated's Third Lantern Award on April 11th at the annual Lanterns and Luminaries event. The other reason is a little bit more obscure because we're here to talk about history. Yours, your famous ships, and the countries. So, 2 years ago, you ascended to a notable post, the first woman to command the USS Constitution in its 226 years. Women have only been allowed in the Navy for less than half that time, since the late 1910s, and it wasn't until 1998 that a woman was able to take command of a combatant ship. So, how did you think about what it meant to be a woman in the Navy when you were first considering joining up, and does it mean something different to you now?
So I actually started this journey when I was 10. And so I was channel surfing one day on the TV, found a Naval Academy graduation, immediately stopped, watched the whole ceremony. And when it was done, went and found my parents and said, I know where I want to go to school. And they thought I was crazy, rightfully so, because what 10-year-old knows what they want to do with their life. And they didn't know a lot about the Navy. I'm from Kentucky, landlocked state. And so they had to really help me find mentors and people that knew that process and what the Navy was going to be like. And so I stuck with it, and I was appointed to the Naval Academy class of 2004. At that point, the class was about 15 to 16% women. So there were women there, the first women from the Naval Academy class in 1980, with a smaller percentage of the class, obviously, at that point, growing every year. And so I graduated in 2004 as a surface warfare officer. So my job description in the Navy is I fight and drive ships and lead sailors. And so that's what I've done for the past 20 years. I'm very fortunate that I've worked with a bunch of great commanding officers. I've almost always been the senior woman at my command, but I knew there were women that commanded ships elsewhere. I just never worked for any of them. And so I knew it was possible and knew that I could one day command my ship if I wanted to.
So there's this great picture of you in high school, actually in 1998, which was the first year that a woman took command of a combat naval ship. You were in front of the USS Constitution. Did it feel like kismet? What was it like at that moment looking up at it? Did you go, I'm going to be on that in ceremonial dress one day?
No, not at all, by any means. And exactly, my family came here to Boston on a family vacation from Kentucky. We drove to Annapolis so I could actually see the Naval Academy. So if you look in the photo, the hat I have on actually says United States Naval Academy. We continued up, stopped in Boston, walked the Freedom Trail, and as luck would have it, my dad happened to take that photo. And so there's no way I could have possibly imagined that that is where the future was gonna place me. But the day I found out I was selected for the position as the commanding officer, I went and found that photo to reflect on it.
So what was it like at the time? We've talked about kind of your trajectory, but thinking about, were there women that you were aspiring to be like at the time? Or was it kind of just the concept of, well, I'd like to be in this field. I'd like to command a boat one day. And that may mean that I am the first woman to do that for any one of these ships. How were you considering your gender as a factor, if at all?
I think I actually didn't really reflect on it at all. I had great captains, like I said, that were all men, but they all were phenomenal leaders that I aspired to be like. And they set a tone of dignity and respect across the command at every level. That was the expectation. And so I think I grew up, I was very blessed to grow up in a Navy where that's the experience I had. And that's how I modeled my leadership behavior, is that we are all to be treated with dignity and respect. We all raised our right hand to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And so we all deserve to do that because we have each other's backs.
And we're going to talk about the specific ship in just a second. But kind of to that point, thinking about the concept of mentorship, who is it that you're overseeing on this historic vessel?
So Constitution is the oldest commissioned warship afloat in the world. And so with that is a fully active duty Navy crew. So it's about 80 active duty Navy sailors. About 60% of them are actually from boot camp for their first assignment in the Navy. And the others all come to the ship from various places in the fleet for basically their shore duty assignment to reset after deployments and operational commitments. And so that is who is out there on the ship every day manning it to make sure that she is maintained. Our mission is to preserve, promote, and protect the legacy of the ship. And so that's what they're doing on a daily basis.
And about that actual kind of day-to-day job, obviously you are not in the remote work possibility crew universe here, but you get up in the morning and you do what?
Every day is a little different. That is the one thing about this assignment and very unique. In a perfect world, I get up in the morning, I go to the gym, I get a workout in first thing because I'm also a mom. So if I don't get that done in the morning, life runs its course during the day. I go in, I do meetings with my upper leadership. So my executive officer, who's my second in command, and my command senior chief, who's my senior enlisted advisor. We're the triad of the ship. And so we sit down in the morning to get priorities straight, talk through what's going on, any issues we need to address. And then they take that word forth to the next level within the chain of command. I usually focus on some emails and correspondence and policies and administrative stuff. And then at some point I go out to the ship, engage with the public and talk to them, see what questions they have and talk about, you know, my life in the Navy and what that's been like. And then at some point probably finish up for the day with whatever taskers are still out there. And then I had to pick up kids from school and get them to whatever activities they're doing, head home, cook dinner, and get ready to do it again the next day. And some days it all gets done and some days it doesn't. And then we try again. But the other great thing with this job is I have lots of great opportunities to go out and engage with the local community. So there's days where I go judge science fairs or I do public speaking or just a variety of things. And that's, while it's very unique, it's also one of the most rewarding parts about the job is getting to represent the Navy and to share those stories.
So you have kind of a dual job as well as you're overseeing command of the ship, because it's not just an extremely impressive floating museum. It is also an active ship. It is floating, and people on it need to then prepare to go out to the next leg of their military career. So how do you approach balancing not just the kind of maintenance and historical and outreach aspect of it, but you're also in charge of people who need to then be ready for active service later on?
Yeah, absolutely. So the sailors, when they get to the ship, they're starting as a blank slate because they don't know how sailors in 1812 lived. They know what the Navy looks like today. And so you have to teach them that. You have to teach them the history of the ship. We still climb and work the sails on the ship. We have some maintenance going on right now. So if you come over, that stuff is not there. But hopefully we'll, by the end of this year, we'll get sails back on. And so you have to teach them that skill set and really work with them. The main sail of the ship is about the size of a basketball court and weighs over 2,000 pounds. So it takes a lot of labor to actually be able to do that and to climb and figure out what that looks like. If you've ever been to the ship, the shrouds looks like the black lines and ladders. That's how the sailors climb. And so that's not something they're always used to doing. So we have that aspect of the job where we focus on that. We do a classroom training session in the winter to re-baseline everybody. And then we'll start very basic with the climbing process as the weather starts to get nicer and the crew will be out there. But then there is the aspect that they're sailors in 2024. And so part of our training program is to talk about what the Navy does today. And it actually always fits in really nicely with Constitution. So Constitution was one of the first original six frigates of our United States Navy. So the pin that every captain wears, not on my 1812 uniform, but in the modern uniform, there's a pin that represents being the captain of a ship. Across the top of that pin is six stars for the original six frigates of the United States Navy, one being Constitution. So every commanding officer in the Navy has a piece of this legacy. But Constitution was built for freedom of the seas, open shipping lanes, and anti-piracy. Missions the United States Navy is still doing around the world to this day. And so it's actually really easy to relate that to the sailors once they learn the history about what that looks like today and sharing with them all those experiences that the more senior people at the command have had throughout their careers and missions that they've done around the world.
And of course, being on the ship, you sort of have to think about its place in history, your place in history. Listeners, a podcast is not necessarily the optimal mode for this one, but I am sitting across from you and you are in a full historic uniform that I hear had to be redone recently to make it more historically accurate. So I think probably start out with the issue of how do you think of what it means to both reflect on, but then also update history? Because like the United States, the military also has kind of a complicated history that you need to think about and I assume talk about with young people like you were every single day.
Yeah, so the uniform's an easy example of we have a historian on site. So Navy History and Heritage Command actually, one, they have a detachment here in Boston. They're the people that do all the really heavy lifting maintenance on the ship. So the mast repair we have going on right now, they're doing that. They also have a historian. And so she and I were talking one day not too long after I took over from the ship, and I had a very heavy wool jacket on in my 1812 uniform, and it was July, and it was very hot outside. And she said, you know, that's the wrong fabric, right? And it spawned a whole conversation for, well, then let's update it to something that is more representative of the time period and take a look at that. And I do think it's important. I tell people all the time, we consistently learn new things about the ship, either that one we didn't know or more facts come out and we have to restructure. And so I think that assessment and being able to critically look at things and continue to have those discussions is very important. And so it absolutely is something that we're always looking at.
I know I'm going to start all of these questions with, and to get into another thing on the history side, but Old North Church has connections to the Constitution that people might not really think about. I talked with Nikki Stewart, who's the head of Old North Illuminated, in a podcast a while back last year, and we were talking about the misconceptions around Paul Revere's ride, but there was a connection because of metallurgy and the ship itself.
So absolutely. Paul Revere is well known for his midnight ride. He's well known for being a silversmith. He was also a coppersmith. So the first ship's bell on USS Constitution was actually made by Paul Revere. The other thing is the copper. So underneath the waterline of the ship, it's actually sheathed in copper. That copper was all provided by Paul Revere as well. And so part of the reason we actually have original pieces of the ship, so the keel or backbone of the ship, is original back to 1795 when it was laid, is because of that copper, because it helped prevent woodworms and marine growth from deteriorating that wood at a much faster rate. So Paul Revere actually has a great connection to the ship as well.
So let's do maybe two different types of story time here. One of them is, do you have a favorite story about the Constitution?
I think my favorite is actually the battle where she earned her nickname. And so part of the great thing about how Constitution was constructed, so when they passed the Naval Armament Act to build those six frigates to reestablish a Navy, they hired a guy named Joshua Humphreys as the architect. And he basically built a whole new class of ship that took the best of speed and firepower and put them together. But he also took the fact that we had really great materials here in the United States that they didn't have in Europe, like these really dense oaks that he wanted to put into the hull design. And so he did that. And when that actually came to the War of 1812, so at the beginning of the War of 1812, American ships were ordered not to engage British ships in one-on-one combat. They were the naval power of the world at that point. We were still a brand new Navy. And so as luck would have it, after a couple of encounters, USS Constitution comes into contact with HMS Guerrier. Guerrier's ready for a fight. She starts to fire on Constitution, originally far enough away the cannonballs are not hitting the side of the ship. But as she continues to close the distance and the cannonballs do indeed start to hit the side of Constitution, a sailor looking over the side sees a cannonball hit and bounce off the side. And he turns to the captain and says, "Huzzah! Her sides are made of iron!" And the captain says, "Ironsides, aye!" And the whole crew knows the ship is wooden, but what it does is it gives them hope that they have a fighting chance now as an underdog to maybe actually win this fight. So Captain Isaac Hull continues on. He's trained his crew. They're ready. They end up victorious at the end of this battle. Constitution returns to Boston, the first major frigate victory for the United States Navy. The nickname of Ironsides is born and has stayed with the ship ever since. And so the fact that that name has stuck and even people know Ironsides as soon as you say it is by far my favorite story.
And we were just down in the crypts of the Old North Church looking at, in fact, the final resting place of Captain Samuel Nichols, the first commander of the Constitution. An interesting example of someone who, of course, is still recorded and still very present in the history and the minds of those who are on the ship, but also, you know, has had to go through sort of historical, I suppose, reconsideration, or we learn new things, or you know, we figure out what parts of a history make sense to highlight and what parts don't make sense to highlight. So how have you, as the most recent, the 77th commander of the Constitution, thought about the first commander of the Constitution?
So one of my favorite places to actually sit in on the ship and reflect is the captain's cabin. It's normally not open to the public. You can look inside, but it is an off-limits section. But I love to go out there and reflect. It really is my favorite place. And so there's a board outside of that cabin that lists the 77 commanding officers of Constitution and their years of service. And so every time I look, and Samuel Nicholson's name is the first one up there, it absolutely, he did not necessarily have what people would consider a successful first voyage for Constitution. But I think, you know, he has his place in history as the first. And so when you look through that list, though, you see other naval heroes as well, like Bainbridge and Preble, Decatur, Porter. Those were people that sat in that space and made decisions for what battle plans were going to look like and what they had to train their sailors to do. And they embodied that in every way possible. And so that's why I love to go in that space and really think about the people that sat in that room before me and what they had to go through and the leadership they had to display.
We've talked about the education portion of your job in sort of a broad way, but I assume you must get a lot of kind of unexpected or interesting questions from the young people that end up coming onto the ship. What's one recently that either like kind of sat you back on your heels a little bit or made you lean in a little bit or think about something a little bit differently?
Yeah, so kids are my favorite group to talk to on the ship because they absolutely see things in a different light. And even for me, the most challenging thing when I first got to the ship was, and I probably should have understood this as a mom, is their line of sight is different. So there were times they would ask a question about, like, what is that? And I was like, I don't even see what you see. And I would have to get down on my knees and go, I have no idea. I've never seen that before, but let me go find out. So there's that piece of it. And then the really little kids always want to know about sea monsters and mermaids and those things, if I've ever seen those being out at sea, which is always kind of fun to talk to them. But the other thing with kids as well, Constitution, the youngest documented sailor on board Constitution was actually 8. So when I see those young kids on board, it's always fun to go up to them and say, hey, how old are you? You look old enough to enlist. Should I go get the paperwork? And they're always like, no. And so it's just their creativity has no bounds for things that they want to do. And it's probably the thing that challenges me the most in a good way to see how I can answer their questions.
Does any specific one kind of come to mind?
Not really. It really, a lot of it is kind of the sea beast and monsters for the older ones. Teenagers usually ask a lot of kind of physical questions about what things are on the ship or what life was like, what was, you know, the basic living skills. What did they eat? Where did they go to the bathroom? And so showing them those things is usually, and now preemptively, it's kind of what drives the conversation. But it's there's nothing off. I'll see if I think of something else. But yeah.
Well, what was the appeal of the post to you? I assume this wasn't something they, just throw at you and you take it no matter what. I assume you did want this position.
Yes, absolutely. So everyone that comes to Constitution has to apply an interview to be selected to serve as a crew member on board. And so for me, what that means is, again, an entire career spent on ships in different capacities. My job before here, I was the executive officer, second in command of a guided missile cruiser when I was selected to command my own ship. And so the way it works for the Navy is we have qualification boards that meet once a year to pick the most qualified candidates. And so the milestone board was selecting all the captains for that year for ships. And so I was selected and then came time to apply for what I wanted. And when I saw that Constitution was potentially an option, it really just spoke to me because I love the Navy. I love being a surface warfare officer, and it seemed like a really great way to pay it forward and hopefully inspire the next generation to understand what the Navy does. And again, how that legacy is the same from Constitution to the ships of today, and to hopefully make an impact and inspire service in others.
How do you think about what it means to be a first, generally speaking? Because obviously you're the first woman to helm the ship, but also that means you are necessarily the first mom, as you noted, to also do that. And in a marriage that also involved, until very recently, both parents in the Navy. So we're in the middle right now in Massachusetts and in many places of talking about, well, how do you construct work-life balance? What do you do when there are childcare shortages? And I can only imagine those sorts of questions end up heightened even more when the question is both a military life and then also a maritime military life. So what has that looked like?
So my husband retired from the Navy last year, and so we have done this whole career together. We met as midshipmen at the Naval Academy, and so it really has been a partnership and a journey for both of our careers. And so there are times where absolutely one of us was gone for multiple months at a time. There was one deployment. We were on different ships but in the same strike group where we spent 9 months kind of proximity-wise next to each other, but not being able to see each other. And so it has its own set of things that complicates it and different problem sets that come to the table. And then absolutely with kids, that dynamic changes to a whole new level. And so again, some days we do great and we get it all done. And there's other days you look at each other and say, well, we could have done better, so we'll try harder tomorrow. But I think for me too, in a leadership perspective, that's where I have a chance to impact the fact that COVID, perfect example, my husband and I were both active duty, both serving, no telework. We were both executive officers at different posts and so had to go to work. But there were days that our son had to do virtual kindergarten and there were days I needed to be home to do that. And so for me, it was about finding even the right time to leave for messaging. So the crew saw me leaving. The crew saw me and knew that, like, I also have to go do this and it's okay if you have to do this. And so, so much of what I talk about from a leadership perspective is we as leaders can't help if we don't know there's a problem. And so that open communication is really what I focus on a lot, trying to foster an environment where people are comfortable coming up to say they need something so that I as a leader can take care of that. Because especially in the military, if those basic needs aren't taken care of and you go over the horizon, your mind isn't where it should be. It's back home because things aren't taken care of. So trying to really instill that in the most junior levels so that they can deal with what they need to deal with and set them up for success and their families up for success. Because in the military, we couldn't do our jobs without the love and support of our families and friends and support structures in whatever fashion that looks like, because it is always a team effort.
So dodging a little bit back on the history side of things, it's not just one very old, very interesting ship that Boston has. We're standing, you know, on a part of the Freedom Trail right now. This was part of the reason that you came to Boston when you were a teenager. So how do you think about the sort of reconsideration and reconfiguring of historic narrative? Earlier in this hour, we were walking around and looking at plaques in the Old North Church that you've been in before and seen as they changed over time. And that often means realizing new things about maybe older figures. So how have you thought about what it means to be in charge of communicating history as it changes to younger people?
So I think the basis of it is people appreciate honest conversation. And so that's really what it is, and a questioning attitude. That's a phrase we say in the Navy a lot, is have a questioning attitude. And so I think that drives a lot of these discussions and things like that. And again, especially as someone who's a first, I think that that's even sometimes challenges things a little bit more for us to go back and to look into those records and see what is there. And some of it is not, you know, necessarily that things were omitted. It's just that the facts weren't presented fully to begin with. And so I think anytime you bring those, you look through it and present it in the most honest way possible, people respond to that.
So what does that look like in practice? Because it's not just a ship management, a ship command process you go through. I assume you also have to kind of go through it with the historians and figure out, okay, well, how are we updating what we're talking about? Why are we updating what we're talking about? What was an evolution of something to do with either military history, Boston history, or the Constitution's history that you really did enjoy delving into?
Yeah, so I think just the naval architecture of the ship was something I never really appreciated until I actually was here as the commanding officer and had time to look at what really made the ship so special. But absolutely, it's a team effort. So our historian goes through things, like I said. Right now, I haven't even had a chance to sit down with her, but last time I was on the ship, she said some of our shot, we have a shot table that shows the different types of cannonballs and shots that could have been used out of the cannons. And she said, hey, we need to talk about this. There are some changes we need to make. So that went on my list. And so we'll address that and figure that out. And then it again goes back to making sure the crew knows that information. And so it's sometimes too, it's combating all the urban myths that have been out in the public for so long, and making sure that the sailors know, you know, if they hear something that's not right, that they also need to correct it in a respectful way. But we are always looking to make it better. But I would say the ship, the great thing about the ship and the structure is that so much of that is still present and you can put eyes on it and then kind of reflect and take it from there.
This does mean I have to ask about urban myths, which is the absolute worst thing. I remember at one point I had a conversation with my mother about how you are taught, you know, back in the day about how stegosauruses had two brains, and that is not true, but that did not stop the Museum of Natural History from putting that on a plaque to debunk it. So there is some risk of repeating something just to debunk it, but I'm going to ask you to do that anyway.
So one of the really common ones I hear is that USS Constitution has to get underway at least once a year to remain a commissioned ship. And that is not true. For example, we have, you know, modern ships today, they go into shipyard periods for extended periods of time and they don't get underway. They remained commissioned ships in the United States Navy. So that is one I hear a lot that is false.
So what are some of the difficulties that you experienced either kind of adapting from, I guess you'd call it like normal duty, to specifically commanding the Constitution, that kind of helps you keep in mind how to prepare your sailors for then leaving the Constitution at some point to then go to another ship or another position?
So a lot of it is actually, so every Wednesday morning I have an hour of time dedicated. I call it Coffee with the CO, and I do it by pay grade. The sailors come in and it's their time. We talk about whatever they want to talk about. This past week was a great example. I had 10 fresh out of boot camp sailors in my office, and they just wanted to hear sea stories. They just wanted to hear about my career and things I've done and what that was going to look like for them down the road. And so I think to being able to share those experiences with them, and again, having some perspective, because some of the things that happened 20 years ago, again, kind of just rewriting history, even my perspective has changed a lot as I've matured and grown and seen more things. And so that experience 20 years ago, I could even tell that story very differently today. And so, and giving them that kind of perspective, for sure. But I think the one thing in this role I definitely underestimated was kind of the public affairs side of things, because again, I'm a surface warfare officer, I'm a naval officer, but it's been really great. And what it really has allowed me to do is to represent the 70,000 women serving on active duty today and over 30 women in command of ships. And I've never been more humbled than when I have a little girl come up and say, I want to be just like you when I grow up.
Does it feel sort of like a community now that there are more women in command of these ships, given again, even when you started thinking about joining the Navy, you couldn't?
We have a great support network. And so Norfolk, Virginia, where I was before, we had a whole lean-in circle of women who were serving in leadership roles across the waterfront there. And I think it's growing all the time. And we absolutely are supporting each other. But I would say collectively, you know, especially with everything going on around the world, is, you know, a lot of my peers are out serving on those ships that are in the Red Sea and the Mediterranean and the Baltic. And so across the board, we all know that we have each other's backs and support each other and are there for anything the other needs. And so I would say the one of my favorite things about the Navy and the surface warfare community is how tight-knit we are and how much we support each other and continue to push each other for those successes that we want to see for each other.
And then I think maybe the last question is something that you've sort of alluded to, which is, you know, how your viewpoint evolves on kind of the reason to join the military when you're a teenager is probably different from your reasons for staying in it now, two decades later. And then also, you know, has it changed the way that you talk to younger people about what it means to be in military service, given, of course, the state of the world today?
So I think absolutely 10-year-old me, again, would have no idea this was the trajectory that I was going to be on. And I even remember having my first deployment when I was overseas. We had pulled into Morocco, calling home to talk to my mom and telling her, like, this is not at all what I thought this was going to be like. And it took some reflection on myself to figure out what, you know, what that shift looked like and then how I actually was going to turn it into something that, you know, here I am 20 years later, that I've made this a career that I've really enjoyed, really loved. I feel like it's made a difference around the world. And so for me, again, it's honest conversation. So when I talk to kids, I tell them everything. I tell them the good and the bad, what I've loved, what's been bad days, what's been good days, what that looks like. But at the end of the day, that I would absolutely do it again. And I am proud to have served in the United States Navy.
Thanks again to Commander Farrell for joining me on the podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer Smith. Our producer is John Gee. Leave a rating and review wherever you're hearing this now if you want to help other folks find us, and email podcast@commonwealthbeacon.org if you ever want to get in touch. We'll be back next week.